The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 14th of February, 2020. On the podcast today, Marie-Claire Dweck, Chief Executive Officer of Newmark Security, NWT is ticker there, and Marie-Claire discusses their recent interim results and strategic review to achieve further growth. Also on the podcast, Russ Mould, Investment Director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about Bitcoin. Yes. Also results from RBS and Barclays. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. And the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see both these lists, top 10 versions of these lists, at voxmarkets.co.uk.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app from voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Marie-Claire Dweck, Chief Executive Officer of Newmark Security. NWT is the ticker there. Marie-Claire, thanks for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Nice to speak to you this morning.
Yeah, I'm sure we've talked a few years back. I'm sure it is. And I've been looking at looking at results. It looks like everything's improving. So it'd be nice. I mean, I know a bit about the company. For people not familiar with Newmark Security, just give us a brief summary as to what it's all about, if you could, Marie-Claire.
With pleasure. Newmark Security has been listed since 2002 on the AIM market. We have 128 employees, four locations in the UK and one in Florida in the US. There's two main divisions to the business. The electronic division, Grosvenor Technology, which has been going for about 30 years, focusing on access control and human capital management. And the other division is our asset protection division, Safetel. And we focus on physical security, ballistic walling and glass, and cash protection.
Understood. And so you recently released your interim results, 6 months ended the 31st of October. Take us through some of the highlights there, if you could, Marie-Claire.
Of course. We released our results a couple of weeks ago. We have increased our revenue by about 3% to 10.1 million. Well, the biggest sort of uptake is that we've had 111% growth in the US, particularly in the HCM market, which is sort of, you know, taken us to about 4.85 million. Access control, we've had some growth as well, 12% there to about 2.3 million. And we've had a decline in our asset protection by 36%. But this was anticipated by us because this is the end of a project for the post office. And with the decline in sort of financial institutions and bank branches closing, we've seen that shift after the last 2 years. But we've taken steps to reduce our outflow and our overheads, and we'll cut cost by about 1.3 million, and we're refocusing that division with new products and new technologies going forward. Mm-hmm. Cash outflow from operations was about 0.1 million, mm-hmm. and our asset increase was 0.9 of a million, taking us to 8.2 million, whereas 2018 was 4.7 million. And our earnings per share from operations continues to about 0.23 pence. And our market cap, as it stands today, is about just over 7 million.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I noticed in the results there, you said there's a strategic kind of review going on. What is that?
Well, the asset protection division has changed its focus somewhat from just sort of cash management and protecting banks and post office and other financial institutions. We've sort of adding a lot more products to our portfolio. We've refocused the group and we're focusing more on our service division. Mm. But really where the real growth and the real strength of the business is coming from the electronic division, where we've sort of developed products for a number of years, time and attendance, or known as HCM products, and we've made huge growth in the US selling to tier one software houses, hence the sort of 111% increase in sales. But what we're also doing is we've primarily been a product only business, but we're developing our cloud based solution and it's sort of selling both product and sort of cloud solutions online. So we'll have two revenue streams going forward, and our new product is going to be ready sort of November this year.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose the advantage of that is what, just recurring revenue?
Most definitely. We have recurring revenue within the asset protection division, in the service division, but we haven't seen this in the physical, the electronic division to date. We've sort of, now we have about 3,500 clocks in the cloud where we charge about $5 a clock, because it's mainly our US clients have taken that up first of all. And we anticipate this being about 20,000 clocks by the end of next year. And, you know, going forward, this is a huge growth area for us. With data security being, you know, of prime importance to our customers, we're sort of being, take some of this on and manage the clocks in the cloud for them.
Yeah, yeah. So you mentioned the, you know, like say US are adopting this. So why is that? I mean, is it just a matter of time before the UK starts to adopt this as well?
I think the UK has adopted this as well, and we've got customers in the UK, some large retail customers that we do manage their clocks in the cloud for them. But, you know, it's a subscription-based model, and it's something that we're starting to push. Our competitors aren't doing it, but it's just the sheer volumes and the scale of the US market for us that we're sort of attacking. And really, for the first time, we can sort of see the tier one customers and software houses buying products from them and sort of making them their flagship products. So, you know, we see huge potential growth for the business going forward here.
Yeah, I was saying that. And what's your ambition then going forward, Mary-Claire? You know, next say, let's look at the time frame, say next 12 months, then maybe, you know, a couple of years down the line, what are you hoping to achieve?
On the electronic division, we'll continue to sell our access control. We have two software solutions and our own hardware solutions in-house, and we'll continue to sell that through integrators, and we'll look forward to some growth there. But the main growth that we look forward to seeing is in the HCM market. Since we've sort of onboarded these software houses, we're sort of really being called upon now for our services and our products. So we see a big shift in the sales of our hardware, but then also in our software and our cloud services model going forward in the next year, 12 months. But that's really a long-term game as a business. And on the asset protection division, we've refocused the business, re-strategized the business, and we see, hope to continue to be in a growth area. And, you know, we look forward to success there.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, if someone's listening right now, Mary-Claire, I like the sound of the progress you're making, but are not yet following the story. Could you give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please?
With pleasure. We're in a high-growth technology and data business operating in large global growing markets, and there's really exponential growth in data security concerns, and we're developing both products and services to address these markets. We're evolving from a pure-play, high-engineered hardware product offering and optimizing the business through development of our cloud-based revenue and recurring revenue streams. And we have an experienced management team with over 30 years in all divisions. And, you know, we're all very excited about the future going forward.
Excellent stuff. Mary-Claire, good to chat to you. And hopefully we'll chat again in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You're up, Russ?
Very well, Justin. How are you?
Good, thanks. Now, we're going to talk today about a bit of old money, bit of new money, that kind of thing.
Yes.
So we've got results from Barclays and RBS, and you've also done a bit of work on Bitcoin, haven't you, as well?
Well, we've had another look. Well, the reason I looked at Bitcoin was that it's back near $10,000 in price. And its trough, if you remember, was about 3,000, and its peak was in December 18, and its peak was about 18,000 in December 17. And, you know, not being funny, I've barely had a question about it for the last 6 or 9 months. Mm-hmm. And blow me down, what's it done? It's gone from $5,000 to nearly $10,000. So it's the old classic thing for you contrarians out there. Where's the, you know, finding the action is moving away from where the action is now and looking someplace else kind of thing. And nobody's been looking at it for a while, and lo and behold, up it's gone.
Yeah.
And I guess the question is now, does this mean that this is a revival of interest in cryptos as a genuine alternative currency? They're back. Is it just a bit of, you know, people having a bit of a punt looking for things that have performed very badly in a world that's still awash with central bank liquidity? And you can either argue away. I mean, in the end, the first question is Bitcoin money? Mm-hmm. And the answer you will say is yes, if on the grounds that money is something that facilitates trade and commerce over time and distance in a trusted fashion.
Yeah.
So it could be pigs, cowrie shells, bits of rock, you know, you electric money, you name it. And I guess the more people that use it and trust it, the more you would have to say, yes, it is potentially money. I guess the big catch with that is, can you go to Sainsbury's and use it? No, because Sainsbury's don't want the faff of it, and it's actually quite expensive for micropayments, and it's not very quick. It's about 7 transactions a second compared to about 1,700 for Visa. And also, you can't pay your tax with it. So, Justin, you could be a Bitcoin billionaire, my friend, and for all I know, you are anyway. And yeah, if you went to Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs and said, I haven't got any pounds, here's loads of Bitcoins for my tax bill, they'd say, do not pass go, Sonny, go straight to jail or hand over the sterling now. So, and I think that's the big stumbling block for cryptos, and it'll be the stumbling block upon which they will always stumble, because once a central bank seizes control of currency, game over.
Yeah, the trouble is, the thing is with Bitcoin, that's what they argue. They argue that now it's so, it's, if you look at all the cryptos traded, Bitcoin is about 70% of all. So now its security is very secure. It's been around for 10 years. It hasn't been hacked. I mean, obviously people have scammed
there's
their
been,
way,
and the people been have stolen scams because they're about stock markets.
People have stolen it. Yeah, exactly. People like people steal money for your bank account. That's happened. People send links and stuff. But Bitcoin itself is a secure sort of decentralized. Has never been broken down. So this is the thing. I don't think it'll ever be. Like I said, used for transactions, because like you say, it isn't that good. It's not as good as Visa. So Visa's quite handy. You know, it's fine. It works. All that stuff works. What it is, though, is this. It is the best, if you call it an asset, it's the best performing asset of the last 10 years. And as you know, you being in the game kind of thing, if you are, say, a hedge fund manager or anyone searching out for returns, and people are saying, well, can you get me some exposure to Bitcoin? Because that's performing very well. In the end, those people want to get exposure to it. And that adoption via institutions will drive the price higher. The fact that the supply is coming down as well means,
the supply is finite at 21 million bitcoins, if you believe the maths. And that's obviously, there's the philosophical libertarian thing. There's also the mathematical thing of supply is finite at 21 million. And in a world where central banks are just creating money out of thin air to keep the show on the road, that will appeal. I mean, that's the case for gold, right? Gold supply grows by 2% a year. And therefore, and there's not much of it around. It's pretty hard to get out of the ground. Whereas central banks, by comparison, can just go, bing, off we go. How many more do you want? And if and when the next recession comes, and as we've discussed before, recessions have not been outlawed, so far as I can tell, just yet. And you would imagine at some stage we'll get one. Given where interest rates are now, there aren't many tools left in the central bank locker. So negative rates and more QE could well come into play, which again may appeal philosophically to some people on Bitcoin or gold or things that are beyond central bank control. Equally, that's their biggest attraction, but it's also the biggest weakness, because central banks will never permit them to become mainstream. Because as Mayor Amstel Rothschild said, you know, show me who controls the creation and the money, I don't care who makes the laws of the country. So once central banks lose control of that, well, they're all out of a job. And that's why, you know, Mr. Carney, who's now the ex-governor of the Bank of England, I think, because it's February, was actually floated at Jackson Hole last year a central bank project to use blockchain and digital currencies. Now, they all trod on Libra very quickly. The Facebook, the genius, said, no, you don't. And all the potential corporate partners, a lot of the corporate partners seem to have drifted away. But central banks are clearly looking at this area, and if they're looking at it, it's because they want to make sure that, I would imagine, they're sat on top of it and not looking on from the sidelines. So philosophically, some people will warm to Bitcoin, some will warm to it because of the QE angle, others will shy away because there's no yield, there's no backing to it of any kind other than faith. But then you could say the same about gold, you could say the same about paper money today. But and also there is the thing of, is a lot of the recent Bitcoin renaissance just because everything else, if you look, has gone up in a straight line in the last 6 months from when the US Federal Reserve began pumping money back into the financial markets. That money's now being withdrawn. If you look at its balance sheet on FRED, the St. Louis Federal Reserve database, it's just starting to shrink again. You can do it for free. And that's going to be a big test, because it may just be coincidence, but a lot of risk assets have rocketed in the last 6 months when that Fed liquidity has been going in. It's now coming out. So let's see what happens.
The thing is, like I said, you know, when something performs very well, people want a cut of it. People want a bit of it, you know, an exposure to it. And that's and the thing with Bitcoin right now, they've got what's called a halving coming up. And that means miners who basically are there to sort of validate the blockchain and they get rewarded. At the moment, they're rewarded, I think, 12.5 Bitcoin per transaction they do, if they get it right. That'll go down. The trouble is, inflation on Bitcoin goes down to 1.8% when it's halved now. So it's below central bank's target rate. So people are saying, because of that and just because of more adoption, because people want exposure to it because it's performing very well. And so that cycle of, you know, being deflationary or not inflationary and more adoption via investors will push it up higher. And so this, I've seen models which, you know, it depends how bullish you are, but I've seen models that you could argue logically that I sort of agree with the stock to flow models, all this sort of, but they're showing like Bitcoin being $100,000 2021, and this guy, and it has conformed to this model for the last, you know, 10 years. Okay. So it's really good one. I mean, it's one of those things, you can be cynical on it, but it's one of the things, if you stand aside and haven't got exposure to it, then you're going to lose out.
I've got a few hedge fund mates still in the States, and you know, they say, oh well, look, you know, we got a fake currency going up, we've got a fake meat company going up, we've got a fake car company, in his opinion, is going through the roof. And so they'll just say, this is all just nuts. So it's going to be one of those Marmite things. Either going to absolutely love it or absolutely be disinterested in it, and there's going to be nothing in between. And, you know, again, as we discuss every time for the listeners, you know, if you are looking at it, you've got to make sure it fits with your overall strategy, target returns, long to your time horizon, and your appetite for risk, which is, as we've seen, it can go down in value as well as up quite spectacularly. So you've got to be willing and able to sit out those sort of price swings.
Yeah, yeah. And Joe, that's quite interesting, is that I see sort of it, people are saying that it sort of could become the American dollar of digital currencies, because you've got the Chinese now are adopting digital currencies. So there's a lot of other countries starting to do it because they realize everything's going digital anyway. But what will be the carry trade kind of thing, you know, or the big one you switch through? And it could be Bitcoin. Like I said, 70% of all digital transactions, all currencies are Bitcoins and blockchain. Bitcoin.
And Bitcoin's market value, by the way, is bigger than that of Shell now.
Yeah, so it's crazy, really.
So, you know, there
you go. Anyway, so love it or hate it. It's been near 10 years. It hasn't been sort of hacked in any way. And the price has been stellar. The returns have been phenomenal. So, you know, but people still knock it, of course. But there we go. If you weren't in it, you didn't get that return. Okay, so let's go to traditional banks.
Traditional
What's
banks.
Happening?
Yeah, we've had Barclays results this week. We've had RBS results this week. And avoiding the more lurid headlines surrounding Barclays in particular. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you actually look, I mean, both share prices have gone down on the numbers. And for the reason that also, although their 19 results were okay and were in line with expectations, even slightly better, and RBS has actually paid out another special dividend today, so it's actually paying out over 20p of dividends for 2019. They've both guided down their return on equity targets for the medium term. So Barclays was looking for 10%, it's now saying it's not going to get there immediately. RBS had started looking for 15, then 12. Now it's saying it's going to be between 9 and 11% by 2021. And there are a number of things at play here, but ultimately, it is just a tough environment to be a bank. Now, I know there'll be no tears shed from anybody listening, and that's absolutely... I mean, RBS has still made 4 billion quid in a tough year, so there isn't going to be too much booing going on. But it's a tough environment to be a bank, because and that's showing up most importantly in their net interest margin. If you think of what a bank does in simple terms, it raises money in one level, either from deposits from customers or in the wholesale markets, and pays an interest rate on that money. It then lends that money out, in theory, at a higher interest rate, and to somebody, best of all, who can pay it back when the loan matures. Mm-hmm. And it pockets the difference between the two interest rates. That's it. That is banking. You can then make it as complicated as you want. Private banking, wholesale banking, investment banking, blah. But ultimately, that's what it is. You borrow money at one, you raise money at one interest rate, lend you that at a higher interest rate, get the money back, bosh. Now, obviously, banks are very good at finding people who then can't pay the money back, which is a separate issue. But at the moment, the big killer is there's a big squeeze on the net interest margin. And at RBS, it's trickling down. And all of them, Barclays by a few percent basis points a quarter. And that's because of this low or negative interest rate world in which we live. Banks, to make that decent margin, need positive interest rates. They need a steep yield curve. And they need wide credit spreads. So a steep yield curve being that, you know, you can the interest rate on short-term loans is below the interest rate on long-term loans, because that's how they pocket the difference. And the credit spread is the difference on a corporate bond and a government bond, because, again, you'll charge a company a higher interest rate because they're more likely to go foot than a government, even if that percentage is still very small.
Yeah, yeah.
But those three things available, normally, the moment we don't have positive interest rates or barely. The yield curve is pretty flat. The interest rate difference between 2 and 10 year bonds is very small on government bonds. And credit spreads, the premium that companies have to pay to borrow relative to governments, is basically at record lows. And so that is the key issue. Now, you've got other issues. Barclays Investment Bank is doing okay, but not brilliantly. RBS isn't doing very well, so they're downsizing it. You've got regulatory pressure. You've got pressure from digital competitors, etc., etc., etc. But ultimately, there is a cost to the central bank's low interest rate world. Yes, it may be keeping the plate spinning, but it's making life jolly difficult for certain people and banks in particular. And that's why these things, if you look at Barclays now, it trades at about 0.7 times book value. Mm-hmm. RBS, just looking at the numbers, the share price is not too dissimilar to that. So you can argue you're paying 70p for every £1 of assets on the bank's balance sheet. So if you bought the whole bank, ran it down, liquidated it, you'd be buying assets for 70p in the pound.
Yeah.
So, but obviously the market is telling you, are those assets really worth that? Are there going to be the bad loans creeping out there? You've got pressure on your margins. And so this, you're either going to believe that they're the biggest value opportunity on the earth because you're buying pound coins for 70p, or they're going to be, you know, fintech to wear, they're going to be the regulatory pressure is going to be there, or in the end, God, heaven forbid, there's going to be that recession that we keep banging on about, and that will obviously be a bit of a different situation as well.
Yeah.
They offer decent yields, so you either think they're value, and lots of value managers are all over these stocks like a rash, or you think they're value traps. Now, what you will see is that there was a big rally in banks in the second half of last year when the market began to think, we've got inflation coming, we've got growth coming, central banks are raising interest rates, the world's going back to normal. And then that all collapsed in a heap in the second half of the year with interest rate cuts and growth worries because of trade and now viruses and everything else. And so, you know, if you see a move from this low growth, low rate, low inflation world to a, quote, more normal world of higher inflation, higher rates, cyclical growth, banks will be a fantastic place to be.
Yeah.
But if we stay in this current environment, they're not going to do you much good at all on the basis of what we've seen for the last 5 or 10 years. And if you use Japan as the example, I know it's an extreme one, but it's, you know, low growth, low rates, low, you know, low inflation. The Japanese Nikkei index is, I think, about 55-60% below its 1989 peak. The banks are down by 90%.
Wow. I know. And do you know what? Looking at the chart of RBS, it's not been inspiring.
It's not pretty. I bet it's not very pretty.
I was just going back to, if you look at, it's like a, from mid 2016, it is like a humpback bridge today. And to the left leg is down there at 150. It doubled actually up until so 2018, January 2018. Then started coming down. There's several false breakouts. On the way down, it is going to break back out, like you say, this start of, or end of last year. It broke up and all the moving averages started going in the right direction. And all of a sudden, it's coming back down again now. So it's something you could have jumped in there several times again. Oh, this is a turnaround here, and it hasn't happened. It just grinded lower, you know. So it's quite annoying.
I think it's because people were assuming inflation was coming in, central banks were going to be raising rates, and they didn't. You know, the Bank of England hasn't raised rates. The Fed actually cut them 3 times last year, and that pulled the rug right from under a lot of them. Although what was weird last year was that the banking sector underperformed in every market in the world except America, where the banks actually had a great year last year. The shares were up, the sector was up by 20-30%. But I think a lot of that is because the Americans dealt with their bad debts incredibly quickly in 2009, and they changed the accounting rules, got rid of mark-to-market. So I think the Americans just dealt with bad loans quicker. Their economy is, on the face of it, healthier than pretty much most other Western economies, and the US banks just were much more ruthless on cost. But in the end, last year, the Fed steps in when the repo market got sticky and dolloped them loads of cheap cash. You know, it's pretty easy to make money then, isn't it?
Yeah, and do you know what? I mean, are RBS paying a dividend these days or what?
It's a monster dividend, actually.
Oh, okay.
It was 2p interim, 3p final, and then a 12p special at the interim and a 5p special today.
Oh, so suppose
that's 2 plus 3, sorry, doing it in my head, 22p of dividends for 2019.
Yeah.
Now, they might not repeat that in 2020, but the consensus regular dividend forecast is 12p, which on a share price of just north of, what, £2? You know, again, that's why value people think there's value there. And they're even talking about doing a buyback if the government lets them. But because they do seem, again, that could change very quickly if we get a downturn or if loan provisions start going up. Which, and it is noticeable that bad loan losses crept up late 18 to mid 19 when central banks were raising interest rates, and that stopped. And because the central bank started cutting through, it shows you we are relatively sensitive to interest rates. And if you think about it, with the world now being, I'm told, 60% more indebted than it was in 2007, which is quite scary, the debt's gone from $150 to $255 trillion, I think. You don't need interest rates to go to 5% to make a big difference, do you? Because there's so much more debt in the system. Yeah. So you're much more... So a lady fund manager described it to me as a lobster pot economy. Very easy to get into, very hard to get out of. Because again, the longer that central banks leave rates low to encourage people to borrow, the harder it's going to be for them to raise it, raise rates, because the impact on borrowers will be so much greater. It's tricky. I'm glad it's not me doing that job, and I'm sure your listeners are thinking the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. It is difficult to know where we're going, because if you looked back when, do you remember that the yield curves inverted last year, and everyone got very worried straight away, even though they said it takes about 18 months for this to play out. And then we've gone there, we went into a bullish end of year pretty much, and then everyone was happy and sort of after the elections and US markets at their high. And now there's this coronavirus, no one really knows what kind of effect this will have on the economy, because all supply chains are breaking down. So we're saying, you know, are we now, people are starting to suggest, you know, there's a recession going to happen again now. It's hard to know, isn't it, what's going on?
It is. I think people are trying to look through the, I mean, well, obviously we're all, first of all, most importantly, you're told the damn thing's contained full stop, because, you know, nobody wants to end up in a John Wyndham novel, you know, so I mean, it's just good to get this thing contained and beaten. But, you know, from the narrow perspective of financial markets, the moment they're looking through it, because they're taking the view it will be contained, it will be beaten, the world bounced back very quickly after SARS and MERS in 2002-03 and 2012, and the Chinese will just throw money at it in fiscal and monetary stimulus to get the economic show back on the road, and that's the current view. My wife works in fashion. Her company, they are, I think, talking that they're not expecting shipments from China to begin till March. So you are already starting to see, and JCB, I think, announced overnight that they're actually cutting production because they're waiting for parts to come from China. So you are starting to see the first signs of stress and strains. Again, markets, I think, will be inclined to view it as look throughable if it's a quarter or two. If it goes longer than that, and I think you probably will see some individual companies kicked about as they say, actually, it's just all gone wrong. And then the question for investors is that just a short-term supply chain China issue? Or has the company's fundamental prospects changed? I think in most cases, people will be looking towards the former. So again, could there be some buying opportunities there if people do panic out? It'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, exactly. Well, do you know what? All you can do, do you know what? Sometimes it's just like Warren Buffett, is ignore the macro noise pretty much. Concentrate on individual stocks, and just try and get them at good levels and invest consistently over time, you know?
Well, I think that's the thing. And I think if you do see some good quality companies, see their share prices flattened because of a couple of quarter supply chain blip, the company isn't fundamentally any different from what it was a year ago. It's just that there's been some short-term noise. And so that's why, to use that example, there could be some opportunities to keep your eyes peeled for. Yeah.
That's
it.
Do you know what? That's when I say, you know, I always worth having some cash on the portfolio, and you shouldn't really worry about recessions, because if you look at long term, the stock market, you know, gives a good return if you.
Well, also they don't last very long.
Yeah. So you should be
relative to periods of growth. Bear markets and up cycles don't last very long relative to, you know. You know, down cycles don't last as long as up cycles normally.
Yeah, exactly. And so the only person who should be worried about a recession is someone who's highly leveraged in some way, overexposed. But if you say all times, people say everything in moderation. Moderation is hard to achieve. If you invest in moderation as well, you do quite well, because you can take advantage of a recession and outperform, you know?
I mean, what you don't want to do, and somebody pointed it out to me, there was a blog that they were reading yesterday, and somebody had tweeted, and he tweeted, "Am I being stupid or what? I'm paying off my 3.25% mortgage. Shouldn't I be putting the money in the stock market when I can get 6 every year?" You're thinking, oh no, that's not good. Because if you pay off the mortgage, that's a guaranteed saving. Yeah. You're not obviously guaranteed to get 6% from the market every year. And you could end up with the debt and a book loss, and then you're in double jeopardy. So you really don't want to see people thinking in those terms at all. No.
Exactly. Marvellous stuff. Everything in moderation. You know, do lots of research and form your opinion. And who knows?
But do your own research, and again, lay out those parameters. Does it fit with my long-term long-term strategy, my time horizon, my target return, and above all, my appetite for risk. And if you're going to bed not sleeping well, you've probably stepped beyond your natural appetite for risk, and that's not the point of the exercise at all.
Yeah. Either that, or you're drinking too much coffee or coconut.
Well, there you go.
Marvellous. Cheers, Fatmers. We'll speak next week. OK, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Market in the last 24 hours. They are five: Vodafone Group, VOD, VOD. Down 0.5% to 151. At four, Predator Oil and Gas, flat today at 5p. At three, it's Novasic. I still don't know how to say that. Novasic. Nice. It's Novacyt. Novacyt. SS. I don't know. NCYT is ticker. Up 28% to 22p. Up 99.5p. At two, Goldstone Resources, up 52% to 2.9p. Number one most followed company is Ormond Mining. It's down 9% to 0.75p. Okay, top five most liked. RS is very quiet today on the news front, I thought. At five, AstraZeneca. Full year and Q4 2019 results. Are they up or down? Down just 1.34% on those news. So there we are. Take from that what you will. At four, Ariana Resources. Due diligence updates. That's Ariana. At three, Jangada Mines. Tenements granted at Pitumbaras Vanadium Project. At two, Jangada Mines again. Shareholder question and answers. And number one, most liked RNS, came from Europa Metals, geotechnical study completed, Toral Project Spain. It's down 6% on that to 0.023p. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.